This evening we're going to talk about the, it's one of, probably this week and next week, we'll spend on the teacher-student relationship. And this is a very important topic, because in a certain sense, it is the heart of Buddhism, and one can regard the heart of Buddhism in a number of different ways. Some would say it's compassion, some would say it's emptiness. I would say it's more closely compassion and emptiness, a very deep relationship there. And in terms of understanding or knowing, that would be quite accurate. But in terms of how things get understood, how understanding arises, the teacher-student relationship is really the heart of the matter. The word sutra, for instance, which you can understand as a scripture, apparently comes from the same root as the word suture. The root meaning is to sew, bringing things together. And what all of the sutras consist of is a question and answer period with Buddha or some other teacher, but usually Buddha. So and they all follow the same format. There's a setting, certain number of people are there, usually monks or arhats or bodhisattvas or some combination of them. And somebody asks Buddha a question and he gives a reply, and then somebody asks another question, he gives a reply. It's Q&A. And this interaction between student and teacher is where understanding begins, where knowing begins. And one can look at it from a lot of different perspectives. One can say, in a certain sense, that the student and teacher are becoming attuned to each other. And through that process of attunement, there is the possibility of a common understanding or a common knowing. One can look at it in terms of, well, this is how the student clarifies his or her experience, or that's how the Buddha explains what he's talking about, and so forth. And in the book that I'm currently reading, it's described that there are four kinds of questions from the point of view of Buddhism. There are those questions which can be given a straightforward answer. That's one. There are those questions which need to be reframed. There are those questions which are best answered by a question. And there are those questions that it is not helpful to pursue. I'm going to develop in the Living Awake series of workshops. We've got one coming up in December, Living Awake with Money and Value. But we have two more scheduled, one in February and one in April. You don't know about that yet, but we've reserved this room for them. One of these, I'm going to explore how to work with actually those kind of responses. You know, when do you give a straightforward answer? When do you reframe it? When do you answer the question with a question? And when do you say, oh, that's not helpful? But just from this short discussion, I mean, when you have a theory of questions, obviously the question and answer thing is being regarded as very, very important. Now, the way that that question and answer process unfolds, how student and teacher interact with each other, so forth. This will be more the subject of our discussion next week. This week, I want to look at the different kinds of teachers and a fairly detailed discussion in Gampopa about that. And I find it wonderfully ironic because, as all of you know, Buddhism makes a big deal about non-self. And yet, and about things not existing independently on their own right, that everything is relative or exists only in relationship to each, to other things. So when I read these, the section on the characteristics of a teacher, I really think it's only half the story. Because you all know the probably apocryphal summary of Berkeley's philosophy, you know, if a tree falls in the wood, doesn't make a and there's no one around, doesn't make a sound. Well, my question is, if a teacher teaches and there's no students, is there a teacher? Does teaching take place? Of course, it's absurd. So one of the things that I want to look at in this discussion is rather than talking about teacher and student as entities, look at what are the conditions in which teaching actually takes place, which is to say, what are the conditions in which learning actually takes place. So let's start off right there. For you, before I go there, a couple of people have emailed questions in, and this is one of the ones that was emailed in, which I think bears very much on this topic. My question is, how is being a student of the Dharma like and unlike being a student in all the other venues we study? I'm asking this because I've noticed I have lots of patterned behavior and reactivity around my experiences in classes I've attended with you and in my experience with distance learning with unfettered mind. For instance, just like in my public school behavior, I like to sit near the front and raise my hand and answer questions. I like to participate. I also like to be a good student, do the assignments, turn in the homework, and if possible, receive recognition for what I've done. But I'm doubting the usefulness of these patterns in Dharma study. For one thing, they aren't getting me the results I expect in a secular learning situation. Yes, you're not getting any A's on the exams because there aren't any exams. Very difficult to get A's on exams that don't exist. So anyway, she goes on like this. And there's another point, which is a little bit of an aside, but I'll mention it. I've also noticed that some students I've grown to admire most from hearing their comments in the podcast say less and less as time goes on. I had a conversation with one of them back at the Mahamudra class last year. I commented that I noticed my eagerness to speak up was because everything looked and felt so much like school. She congratulated me on noticing this and told me she tried not to say anything because she does not like hearing herself in the podcasts. I told her I felt the reverse about her participation. And I began to notice that her comments had become rare. Now, right now we have almost 90 people in the Then and Now class group on Facebook, you know, and I have no idea how many. You didn't know that, Joe?
How many there were?
Yeah.
No, I was actually laughing at her reason for not speaking up.
Yeah, because she doesn't like hearing us. Yeah, obviously she's not in the acting profession, right?
No, but it's interesting.
Microphone, please. Want to capture every word here, Joe?
No, obviously, I was going through a whole projection of my own about why she spoke at the beginning and why people appreciated it and then missed it, and then to have you say it was because she didn't.
Well, no, like that's her. What she wrote to. That's what this person wrote to me. She had a conversation with the person,
yeah.
And you yeah. know, yeah, and.
Well, I go through the same thing, whether to raise my hand. You know, I begin to feel like Hermione and Harry Potter here. I've come to the conclusion that that's part of our responsibility.
Well, I'm very glad you take it that way. I hesitate to lay that on everybody because I don't want there to be any coercion here. I would put it slightly differently and say that when you ask a question and participate in discussion, there are several things going on. One is you're asking a question which you have. And I think most of the questions that are asked aren't my sense is the questions that are asked here aren't to look good in class, which is exactly what happens in the academic environment. You know, you ask a question to look good. But there are questions coming out of points that people want to clarify or elucidate or have a deeper understanding. So they're coming from a place of genuine interest. And that's one of the differences between this environment and an academic environment. This is not... that will also operate in an academic environment, but a lot of other stuff operates. You want to impress the teacher so you get your A and, you know, and so forth, and lots of things. And also your academic classes are also play an important role in your careers. This is probably not going to be directly helpful for your resume or anything like that. I mean, I'll be delighted if anybody puts this class on their resume, but I think the chances of that are pretty slim. But when, so in addition to questions coming from an interest in learning and deepening one's own understanding, they are also an act of generosity because we are recording them. And I've got many, many emails. I get about one a week, actually, expressing appreciation for the podcast for this class. And many of them mention the interaction because, I don't know, what were our stats? There's somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people downloading this.
Depending on which. Well, yeah. Or
600, 700 easy. Yeah. So when you ask a question, probably... 10 of those people have the same question. And when I answer, when I interact with you, yeah, I'm putting you on the spot. I mean, I know that very well. It's why a lot of people don't come to this class, because they don't want to work with me, because I put people on the spot, and I'm not shy about doing it in public or in private or whatever like that. Because it is through that process of you're engaging your material right in the process of interaction that something actually happens in terms of understanding. And when people listen to this, and as far as I know, Unfettered Mind is the only podcast which is actually putting the student-teacher interaction out there. I had emails saying, somebody asked this question, I had the same question, it was so helpful hearing how that interaction went. Because they could actually just follow it along themselves. So it's an act of generosity, and I don't really want you to look at it as a responsibility. I have to ask this question to help everybody. But it is something, you're actually giving something to the rest of the world by participating. So when I read this, the person doesn't like listening to her podcast herself on the podcast, so she talks less and less. Felt a little sad about that. I can quite understand it. And... while it's an act of generosity, I'm under no illusions, it also requires a certain amount of courage on your part, because even though we're in this environment and there doesn't seem to be anybody around, there are actually a whole bunch of people listening. and that's how it is. So with that, it's very different I mean, I could sit up here and talk and just, you know, give a straight lecture. And some of you would get something out of it, and others would just listen, and something would be absorbed, maybe. But when we have the actual discussion and we and push on points, that's where something really begins to move. And that's why I encourage questions, I enjoy questions, I enjoy the interaction, because it's meeting that resistance and working the resistance and feeling the shift and experiencing the shift that takes place that plants the seeds of understanding, which are then grow through your own practice. So there are some important differences between this kind of class and an academic class, a standard school class. But the person who wrote this letter is quite right. We import exactly the same behaviors because it looks the same. And next week, when we talk about how teacher and student interact in this kind of environment, it will. We can go into that in a bit more detail, like which behaviors are appropriate and which aren't, and so forth, and why. How many of you know a film called Meetings with Remarkable Men? Okay. For those of you who don't know it, it's directed by Peter Brook, and it's the supposed life story of a very interesting individual who lived latter part of the 19th century, first part of the 20th. He died in about 1950, I think, called Gurdjieff, who started teaching in Moscow, and then in the when the revolution came, moved to Paris. And he was a very, very insightful, a profound teacher, and established a whole school which still continues in some way today. But I in his younger years, he traveled around Central Asia looking for various teachings. And in one of the scenes in the movie, there's a teacher who's sitting under a tree, and around the teacher are sitting a bunch of students, you know, in more or less a circle, and they're asking questions. So this format, which we have here, we have a person sitting here and a bunch of people sitting around asking questions, engaging in discussion, this is the primary format for spiritual teaching. That's how it has taken place and done for literally thousands of years. And it's a very simple format, it's very straightforward, but when we gather here each evening, Tuesday evening, we're actually reproducing or recreating something that has been tried and tested and done literally for centuries or millennia. What taking place here is that I've had the good fortune to receive a certain amount of experience and training. You have a certain interest, and through this interaction, some seeds or understanding is planted or awakened in you, which you then mature through your practice, and you seek clarification and so forth. In a way that you find yourself becoming awake and present in your life the way you want to be. It's as we were discussing last time, it's not about instilling a set of beliefs, but it's really about exploring one's own experience and exploring it as deeply as we are able to. So that's a kind of long intro to this evening. Now, let's take a look at the texts. Page 32 in Gunther, and page 71. In Kenchok Jaltsen. do we start on this? I'm going to throw out a question here. What actually is the teacher?
I think the teacher is the translator.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
Like a translator of a language. It's like learning a new language, looking at a subject, and you need someone to. If it's not immediately understandable, mm-hmm. you need some help to kind of make the crossing.
So I think that's right. What's certainly one of the functions the teacher performs is to translate or actually teach a certain language, a language in order that's useful for understanding how to wake up and be present. And in our case, you know, especially when we're reading Gunther, you have to translate Gunther from English into English. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the functions of a teacher. But what is the teacher?
The teacher is experience.
That was a big jump. I'm going to need some help here, Joe.
What actually changes me, opens me to the possibility of change, is experience. The teacher has experience. And
I think you need to go a step further. Not that the teacher has experience, but you go back to your original statement. You said
the teacher is
experience. From the Japanese Zen tradition, maybe it's from China, I don't know, but there's a story of a Zen master who, whenever anybody asked a question, didn't matter what the question was, he would go. He would just hold up his finger. Just like that. And that was the only thing he ever did. One day, one of the young monks in the monastery was attending this master, and the master said, asked him a question about something or other. And the young monk went like this. With absolutely no hesitation, the Zen master whipped out a sword and lopped off the finger. And the young kid was like, "Why'd you do that?" And the teacher went, out of his finger. And the kid woke up. Teacher's experience. Okay? And I think this is a very good way. We think of the teacher as an individual or something outside of us. But what happens, in just the way that I was talking about earlier, is when you and I interact, an experience arises. And it's in that experience that learning or understanding takes place. So I think what you say is very good here. The teacher is experience. Now, that being said, I think we have to go into it a little bit further. Randy, did you have something? Yes.
not only is the teacher experience, but the teacher is someone who can help my experience, who can tune in. If I, you know, each individual's path is unique, mm-hmm. and to tune into that unique path and say, well, you're stuck here, or you're off the path altogether, you're moving in the wrong direction, and kind of nudge it back in the right place from
the
teacher's experience.
Yeah, these are functions of that arise in the teacher-student interaction. But what we actually learn from is experience. Okay, Agnes, did you have?
I don't know. In my mind, the analogy is like when I go scuba diving, you know, have a guide. I dive enough. The guide obviously dive for that particular body of water, and the guide will point out what to see, mm-hmm. what not to do. The particular experience that I wouldn't have by myself, or it took long time to trial and error.
Yeah,
is this appropriate analogy?
Well, that's one of the analogies we had from last week. Gampopa talked about three functions of the teacher. One was as a guide, one was an escort to protect, and the other was the ferryman, the person who rowed the boat, which is a source of strength and knowledge. But again, we're looking at it as something outside of us. And what I want to do is to look a little deeper. You see, one way to look at this, there's a school in Buddhism called the mind-only school, or actually is probably a better translation, is the experience-only school. There's just experience. So I'm here, and there isn't anybody else here. There are a bunch of forms that look like people, and they speak, and they have arms and legs and clothes and things like that. But all of that's just experience for me. And so I'm interacting with my own experience. You follow? It's a bit of a weird way of looking at it, but to take it a step further, it's as if I'm dreaming. Now, in a dream, somebody comes and talks to us, and we have this whole interaction, but it's something just taking place in mind. There isn't actually another person there. And it's one way of looking at our experience now. So from this point of view, the teacher is simply as maybe overstating it, but is that aspect of our experience that is trying to tell us how to wake up. You follow? But it's still our experience. Okay. Michelle, Maya, could you?
I tend to think of my experience with you more as something like a mirror, mm-hmm. for what I'm going through, but not in the traditional sense that we would see a mirror as a, say, a painting on the wall, like the one behind you with a frame, but more like when you're camping in the Sierras and you get up in the morning and there's a perfect reflection in the lake and the mountain meets the lake, but when you look at it carefully, you see that there are differences between the mountain and the sky and the reflection because there are reeds and logs and whatnot in the lake.
Okay. And that's certainly one way of looking at the teacher-student relationship. But if you look at a little more, if you take your analogy a little bit, just look at it a little differently, you're still learning from experience. Okay. Now, This is what I want you to keep in mind when we look at this first part here. There are four classifications of spiritual masters. The ordinary spiritual master, the bodhisattva spiritual master who's attained certain bhumis. Bhumis is a Sanskrit word for stages or levels. The nirmanakaya spiritual master and the sambhogakaya spiritual master. Yeah, it's very interesting. Both Gunter and Kensho Gyaltsen chickened out and they didn't translate Nirmanakaya or Sambhogakaya. These four types are related to an individual's spiritual realizations. When one is ordinary or just beginning, one cannot attend Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who have attained higher levels of spiritual masters, so one attends an ordinary spiritual master. When one's karmic obscurations, read that as distortions, are more purified, bad English, one can attend a bodhisattva spiritual master who has attained higher levels. After one accomplishes the great accumulation path, one can attend a nirmanakaya spiritual master. When one attains the bodhisattva's level, one can attend a sambhogakaya spiritual master. Okay, so we need to do a couple of things here. One of the central frames, I suppose, in the Mahayana, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, but in most of Mahayana and Vajrayana, is this what are called the three bodies or three kayas. Kaya is a Sanskrit word which means body, of Buddha. And they are Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, Dharmakaya. Now, not sure where these came from. There's been a fair amount of research, but one possible reading is it finds its origin in a line in one of the sutras in which Buddha says, "He who sees my form does not see me." That is, if you think Buddha is the physical form, then you don't really understand what Buddha is. It's probably more accurate to say Buddha is a way of experiencing the world. So if you think of Buddha as an entity, you're already off the mark. And if you think of Buddha as a person, you're really way off the mark. So the wonderful Indian mind then says, okay, so he who sees my form does not see me, then Buddha must have a form which we can't see. And that must be the true form of Buddha. That's what Dharmakaya means, the true form. Now, what is the true form of Buddha? It is the emptiness or the ineffability of experience. So now you had the true form and the form. And Nirmanaka or Rupakaya was the first one, which literally means the form. Rupa is a Sanskrit word which means form. Kaya means form, so the form body or whatever. So you're just saying the same thing twice. So you have the true form and the physical form. Then somewhere along the line, I'm not quite sure where, the physical form or the form got split into two. That is, the subtle form and the actual form. And the subtle form has, some would say, has much more to do with energy and so forth. That became known as the Sambhogakaya. And then the other one became known as the Nirmanakaya. And there's various ways of thinking about this and understanding this. But it's important to understand what these really refer to. The Dharmakaya refers to the emptiness of experience, the emptiness of awareness, actually. The Sambhogakaya refers to the clarity, the natural clarity of awareness. And Nirmanakaya refers to the unrestricted experience which arises in awareness and is not different from awareness. Now, that's getting into some really deep stuff, which we'll get into much later in this text, but we need to this framework just right now. So, and just a little footnote, I'm fairly sure that this notion, these three kayas of Buddha came from the same source with which the Holy Trinity comes in Christianity, where you have God, the Father, God, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, except that they made it into something much more concrete with a whole bunch of theological problems that came out of that. I remember reading a Greek Orthodox presentation of the three persons of God. It was just like mind-bogglingly complex. I couldn't make any sense of it whatsoever. Raquel.
What's the difference between Buddhas and Bodhisattvas?
Okay, that's a good point. Very loosely speaking, Bodhisattvas are apprentice Buddhas. To make it a little more refined, we also need this. In all traditions of Buddhism, there is a map of spiritual progress known as the five paths. There's a path of accumulation, path of accommodation, path of seeing, path of practice, and path of no practice. And in the path of accumulation, you're developing, generating the goodness and the well-being which lays the foundation for spiritual understanding. And there's a long exposition way at the end of this book on the five paths. Well, not long, but sufficiently detailed one. The path of accommodation is where you begin to get some intimation of what experience is actually like, you know, the emptiness and so forth. And so there's a process of accommodation to that. Path of seeing is where you actually wake up. But when you wake up, you have certain experience of being awake and present, but it's not fully integrated in your life. So the path of practice is where you're working at integrating all aspects of experience into this seeing that has been uncovered. And the path of no practice is when that process is complete. You become officially a bodhisattva when you enter the path of seeing. That is, you understand the nature of experience directly. And then you go through all of the stages of a bodhisattva until you get to the path of no practice, which is equivalent to Buddhahood. So from this point of view, from this map, what Buddha represents is the way of experiencing things in which you can experience all aspects of experience awake and present, which means you can experience everything that arises. Remember, we talked about this, the developing the ability to experience everything. The understanding and seeing of a bodhisattva and a Buddha are the same. The degree in which it has permeated all experience is different. Okay? So that's why I say bodhisattvas are Buddhas in training. Okay? Randy.
A little further along in the somewhere, Gunther translates Nirmanakaya as the realm of overt action and Sambhogakaya as the realm of verbal communication. Neither of which I understood one bit, and I don't know if it's accurate.
I think it's in
two or three chapters ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, let's wait until we get there before. One way of looking at the three kayas is that the Dharmakaya is how things are. Well, let's do it very directly. Okay. Take a nice juicy emotion, everybody. You know, anger, hatred, lust.
Envy.
Good one. Pride. Shame. You know, just something that you can take love, compassion too, but just make it nice and juicy. Okay? So bring it up. And feel it as strongly as you're able to. And then look at the experience of the emotion. What do you see? Look at the emotion, whether it's anger, envy, sexual desire, love, compassion, faith. Look at the emotion itself. What is it? What do you see? Anybody?
Energy.
You see energy, Joe?
See, you say.
Yes, see. I said look, so
nothing.
I mean see. Yeah, you don't see anything, okay? That's the Dharmakaya aspect. Do you experience the emotion? Okay, you experience it vividly. That's the Nirmanakaya aspect. Okay? Now, the next one's a little bit tricky. I want you to simultaneously experience the emotion, knowing there's nothing there, because that's what you see. What happens when you do that? Experience the emotion as completely as possible, while knowing it is not a thing. What happens? Chuck?
It seems to lose its energy. It doesn't drag you in.
Yeah, there's a shift, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that shift is what the Sambhogakaya refers to. You're experiencing things in a higher level of energy. So the energy of the emotion is going out into the attention, so you're experiencing things in a different way. And that's what the three kayas are actually referring to. Now, this is a very, very quick... Linnea, do you have a question?
I do.
Okay.
Is it... As you're describing this, I can... see, I guess, applications
mm-hmm.
for relating to the different kayas when meditating. And I guess what I'm wondering is it useful to be aware of the different ways of experiencing it the way you've described?
Actually, yes, it's very useful.
Okay.
When you're in the grip of an emotion, how empty do you experience it?
You don't unless... Well,
you don't at all, right? You're in the grip of it. Okay, would it be useful to experience the empty aspect? Okay, so that's one thing, okay? And you'll also find that if you make a point of experiencing the emptiness and the vividness together... just as Chuck described, you don't get caught by the emotion the same. You actually start transforming the energy of the emotion into awareness. So this is very, very useful. So it's a good thing to cultivate. You can't do it by thinking. You have to actually just do it. Okay.
May I ask one more question about that?
Oh, I'll let you, yes.
looking at something and seeing that there's nothing there,
yeah.
The way you describe the Dharmakaya, or that, I don't know.
Dharmakaya aspect is what I said, yeah.
For me, seems like awareness, but not the actual full experience.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, there's just a kind of understanding of it.
So I guess I'm not understanding how that aspect relates to actually really being in one's experience.
Oh. When you develop a sufficient capacity and attention, then when you do something like look at experience, you actually experience everything being empty. It's not a case of understanding it intellectually. It's how you experience things. So you can experience the mind having absolutely no foundation, no root, a complete and utter groundlessness, or that there's nothing in mind which changes. Nothing in experience, we have all this appearance of change, but there isn't anything which moves, things like that. These are actual experiences which arise when you have a sufficient capacity of attention and you direct it in certain ways. Okay. Michelle?
I'm sorry, I'm stuck on a question about Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Do you mind if we go back to that?
Mm, no.
I thought that Avalokiteshvara is considered a Bodhisattva.
Ninth level.
More, please.
He's the ninth level. There are 10 levels of Bodhisattva. He's ninth. He's too short of Buddhahood.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah. Manjusri is 10th.
Yeah. There's
good. Yeah, he's considered a Bodhisattva. Okay. Kyle.
I can understand the benefit of experiencing the emptiness and the emotion at the same time, but wouldn't it be is the ultimate goal of the practice to ultimately go without the emotion? Because it seems that if the emotion doesn't really exist, and things like anger and other emotions like that can cause so many problems, wouldn't it just be easier just to
get rid of them?
Yeah, like that.
Yeah. Easier said than done, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that would obviously you'd have to approach it in a very careful way, because would there be a way of doing that without ultimately maybe, I don't want to use the word suppress, but...
Well, you might become a nation of zombies. They don't have any emotions. That's not the point. We live, we breathe, we have thoughts, we have emotions. Very broadly speaking, there are two kinds of emotions. There are reactive emotions and emotions which are responses. The reactive emotions are organized around a sense of self. So there are things like attraction, aversion, indifference, pride, jealousy, greed, things like that. They arise. And when they arise, because we don't have a sufficient capacity of attention, they swallow us. So we get angry, or we get proud, or what have you. But as you practice and you develop a greater capacity and attention, then you are able to experience the arising of the emotions without being distracted, without being swallowed by them. And then they just become an experience. And that's where what I was talking about comes in. One experiences them as just being no thing, just a movement, as it were. And it's very, very different because you're not confused by it. So saying, okay, let's get rid of the emotions, it's a little bit like saying, well, you know, it'd be nice if the ocean was always calm. There weren't any waves on it. Because one way of looking at emotions is they're simply mind waves. Okay. But it's the nature of the ocean to have waves. It's the nature of for the mind to move and have waves. The question is that organized on a sense of self with all the destructiveness of that? Or can it be experienced openly and freely so it doesn't cause the locking or the reactivity that is the basis of suffering? So what we're doing in Buddhism is actually not trying to get rid of emotions, but trying to develop the ability to experience them completely so we're never confused by them. You sure?
I had a little click in my head, and it kind of fed back into something I was reading in Wake Up to Your Life.
Yeah.
So it's not so much maybe separating yourself from the emotion itself, but
that's right.
But the it goes back to separating yourself maybe from the reactive.
Well. Yeah, I mean, it's funny what people do with English here. Because I talk about this process, and everybody says, well, you're stepping back. That's actually not, you know, you're stepping back from the emotion. That's actually not what happens. What happens is you step into the emotion with awareness, and when you step into the emotion with awareness, then you have a far more intimate relationship with it, and there's far less confusion. So it's not stepping away and getting some kind of equanimity because one has some distance. It's finding stepping right into it, and because one is right in it, and is able to be there with presence, there's no confusion. So there's a stability and a relaxation that takes place in the emotion, which is a very different thing, and it's very different from stepping back, which naturally leads to a kind of suppression, actually. Okay?
Okay.
Again, this is something one develops in through practice. Did you go to Gene's group?
Or no, not this week.
Okay. I'm not sure whether it's every week or what. You'll have to check with her. Okay. Okay. So, we're looking at the teacher as experience. Now, from a mythic point of view, I mean, this is being expressed very, very mythically. What I want to point out is that whether you have an ordinary teacher, an ordinary human being, a bodhisattva, nirmanakaya or sambhogakaya, all of these are very specific experiences. And it's those experiences which give rise to the possibility of learning. And so, mythically, this would be interpreted like the Nirmanakaya Buddha. You have the good fortune to be born, you know, in the time when a Buddha is actually walking on the earth and so forth. But another way of understanding this is that at that stage of awakening, you're able to experience everything as being awake to some extent. So everything becomes your teacher. And not just externally, internally, you're clear enough about the nature of mind that you actually learn through its unfolding. If you look on the website under translations, you'll see a song which I translated, written by a 13th century teacher called Chergongpa, 12th, 13th century, something like that, called Recognizing Your Mind as the Guru. And it's a beautiful song. It's one Rinpoche told me to study very, very carefully. And so, like 30 years later, I translated it. Well, better late than never. But it's very much about the Nirmanakaya and Sabhogakaya experience of the teacher. So it's something you can look at. Of these four, who is the greatest benefactor? When we are in the obscuring darkness of the karma of afflicting emotions, we have no opportunity to even see the face of a superior spiritual master, so how could we attend one? In other words, you're stuck with ordinary beings. By meeting ordinary spiritual masters, receiving the light of their teaching, shining it on the path, one will gain the opportunity to see the superior spiritual masters. This isn't like you're going to see people in astral bodies and things like that. It means that you move into a deeper and deeper relationship with your own mind. But it is a person that we interact with. For most people, that provides us with what we need to begin this path, and that's why it says here that the ordinary human individual is the most important one. There's a great deal written about this. A lot of people have asked me to, you know, tell them how to find a teacher. Well, it's one of the great challenges of the spiritual path. And it's not straightforward. I don't think there's any rules or, there's the old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Well, that's nice. That just makes it very easy. And some people look for years and years and years before they find someone, and some people happen into one seemingly by chance. Or as Trungpa says, the illusion of accident. One thing that I have come to appreciate is that of the relationships you have in your life, the relationship with the spiritual teacher is one of the most important, and it's probably easier to replace a husband, a wife, or a boyfriend, or a girlfriend, than it is to replace the relationship with a spiritual teacher. That's not universally true, but generally speaking, it's a very important relationship, and there are many, many things which make it difficult to form. So if you have the good fortune to find someone that you feel you can actually work with, then that's something to take quite seriously. How do you know who is your spiritual teacher? I put it into one sentence. It's someone you will listen to no matter how crazy you are. You know, it's someone who can cut through, the relationship is such that no matter how completely nuts you are on some emotional issue or something like that, when you have interaction with him or her, something in you wakes up and you step out of that craziness. So that's why I say it's someone you'll listen to no matter how crazy you are. Okay. Now, let's go through the various kinds. Nirmanakaya and Sabhogakaya spiritual masters. Now, the way that this talked about here, it's as if it's somebody outside. But this is really, at this level of experience, you're experiencing the clarity and naturalness of mind itself. And it goes back to how we started the discussion. This is the teacher is experience, and the experience of mind itself, the experience of emptiness, the experience of clarity, the experience of just how things manifest, which would be the Nirmanakaya, overt action, if you wish. All of this fuels or continues an awakening process in oneself. When one's very present, and you have a high enough capacity and attention, then as thoughts arise, each one of them precipitates a moment of awakening or elicits. It's like, boom, boom. And that's something like what they're talking about here. It's in that direction. Then we have bodhisattva spiritual masters. They have all of these powers. Anybody know anybody like this? You know, anybody can live as long as one wishes, maintain meditative concentration as long as one wishes, shower down a rain of limitless necessities on sentient beings. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? What's actually going on here? This is mythic language. Yes, Kyle.
Well, as far as the one can live as long as one wishes,
please hold the mic like that.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, from what I've read and think I understand is that there's with something like impermanence, it doesn't you don't necessarily want to live forever in the sense that a lot of people would. You are more willing to to use kind of a cliche, accept your own time or something mm-hmm. like that.
Okay. That's one possibility. Anybody else? Joe?
I found at one point that I could further classify these four into two, one of which the text suggests we will meet, and the other three, the test suggests we won't meet.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason we won't meet those three is that because when we get to the point where these experiences are real to us, there will be no Buddha because Buddha is, in fact, a concept. And those concepts will disappear. And I suppose each of these 10 are levels of experience, or can be seen as levels of experience,
mm-hmm.
that will cease to have these kind of categorizations and separations because they will no longer be concepts, they will be experiences.
Yes, and my invitation to you right now is, what are these experiences? What is the experience of power over life? What is the experience that power over mind refers to? What is the experience that power over birth refers to? I'm going to make you sweat a little bit.
I can what?
I'm going to make you sweat a little bit.
Thank you. I suppose, since I am not there right now, it would be an experience of the relative nature of, say, birth, of the dependent nature of birth. I don't know, I'm making this up. I ain't there.
My point here is that it's not a case of being there, because that's all making it out there. And the I think we can understand this in a way it's much, much closer to home. And one of the problems, things that I think it's good to keep in mind here, much of what's being talked about here is in mythic language. It's highly symbolic. And what I'm trying to do in the part of this Then and Now class is help you translate the symbology into actual experience, because people tend to take the symbology literally. So let's start with power over birth. It means one can maintain meditative concentration, and if born in the desired world, one will not be affected by its faults. Well, in the prayer that we do at the beginning, we say, suffering is present in all six realms, may I not be born in those states. Now, in mythic vocabulary, you regard the six states, six kinds of beings as actual places where one will take birth. But in the way that we tend to approach things, says to be born in one of the realms is to succumb to that particular emotional projection. You with me? So, from that point of view, what would power over birth mean? Kate? Joe, could you have the mic?
Well, I'm thinking maybe it would be a moment of presence.
Yeah, I think we can go a little bit further. That is, we can move into any way of being intentionally at any moment. So I can drop into quiet, stable attention. I can move into compassion or loving kindness. Even if I move into desiring something, it's not the same kind of clinging desire. So what I want to suggest here, that these are, it's not talking about magical powers or anything like that, but these 10 powers are talking about ways that we're able to work with our own experience. So being able to move into any state of mind at will. Well, that's actually pretty impressive. Kara, Michelle, could you pass the mic, please?
Sort of what I was thinking even previously when you brought this up was John F. Kennedy saying we have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Actually, I think it was...
Churchill said that.
It was Roosevelt.
What? Well, Kennedy, did Kennedy quote him or something?
Of course, yes. No,
I was around back then, you know? Yeah. Like, that's right.
That's Kennedy, yeah. it was Franklin Roosevelt said that at the
beginning. That's right.
In the Second World War.
I could hear it in my head in like a Boston accent. I don't know. It's late. maybe it was my like seventh grade math teacher. She yes. talked like that too. where's the hypotenuse? take this away from me. What I was gonna say
yes,
is that
please.
I think that a teacher from whom I could learn is someone who is capable of transcending emotion. Not transcending it. I don't know what the proper way of saying it is. Like when you watch a child get really freaked out about something.
Yes.
And you're like, dude, it's a bug and it's this big. Like, chill out.
Okay.
You know? When a good teacher is someone who can impart that wisdom to you and help you attain I don't want to say like get above it. But when I see someone who is able to do that, where I would flip out over even a minor thing, and then I can see someone in the same situation with me, you know, remain calm, or
then
that is someone from whom I can learn, and that is someone that I would point to as having attained a higher level of, not a higher level, but.
But I think we need to be very, very careful here.
Okay.
Do you ski?
Yes.
Okay. You watch these people ski in powder?
Yes.
Nice to watch, isn't it?
No.
You don't? Why?
Because it's my empathy just kicks in and I'm terrified.
Why are you terrified of powder?
I fall down a lot.
Yeah, okay. See, when you're skiing in deep powder, you have to be totally attuned to the snow. Right. Because it looks, I mean, you see these guys just go, just so they make it look so easy.
Right.
But when you're actually doing it, you find that the snow is varying all the time. It's pulling at your boots, it's pulling at your skis and things like that. Right. And what these people are able to do is to make these micro adjustments so quickly that the when you look at it, it's just so smooth. Mm-hmm. And this is the same in any area. I'm just using skiing as one example. You watch somebody play tennis, you watch somebody play golf, you watch somebody do things, and it looks so effortless. Mm-hmm. And but it isn't that they aren't. The more that you learn, the more refined your movement gets. So it isn't. This notion of transcending emotions, I think, is a very dangerous one, because I don't think that's what happens. I think it's that one becomes so attuned that one can make those adjustments as emotional material is arising. So they actually experience it, but they're never caught by it the way we are. We get clumsy. Right. And so it looks like they're unmoved, but actually they're moved, they know the emotions the way, actually they know them even more intimately than we do. But they aren't caught or confused by them. And that's very different from transcending them, if you follow.
Well, I guess I think of transcendence as like the ultimate detachment.
Yeah, and...
But not in the negative sense.
I understand, but I even want to push on that one a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because... rather than detachment, which is kind of like this, it is not attaching at all. So it arises, but you don't attach, so you're never caught. So there's just a continuous smooth movement. And it isn't that the emotions don't arise, it's that they arise, but they... Because one isn't attaching at all, the emotional energy can move freely and it doesn't create the hiccups and the bumps that reactive emotion does. Okay. But I just want to encourage you not to think of it in terms of transcendence, but actually intimate experience of the emotion with a high level of attention so that one isn't caught by it. Okay, Michelle, then Jean, then Randy.
I like your powder analogy also, because the only way to ski powder is to keep your weight forward. The moment you lean back on your skis,
you're dead. Yes.
You're dead, exactly. And there's a nice analogy there to being disconnected.
And you can't do anything suddenly. You know, you just didn't, and when you're skiing in powder, and I'm not very good at it, but the few times I've got it, you just think about turning, and you turn.
It's like skateboarding.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
You also can't do anything halfway. As soon as you lean heavily on one ski, you're dead.
Yeah.
You have to be very balanced.
Yeah. Jean?
I was just thinking of it in terms of being reactive or responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And I... When you talk about reactive emotions, that brings thoughts, negative thoughts. But if you're responding to emotions, then to me that's an interaction and without attachment. But
Yes. The point that I'm trying to express here is that stuff's arising in everybody, but it's how we experience it that makes the difference. And when a reactive emotion arises, there is something there that we don't want to experience. And that's what produces the reactivity, where there's always a pushing away or a protecting. But when something happens and we don't need to protect ourselves, then the energy just moves, and it doesn't come out as a reactive emotion, doesn't come out as anger or jealousy or something like that. It comes out as clarity or what have you. Yeah.
Just one comment. I've found it as a student that I learn, probably only learn when I'm responding rather than when I'm reacting.
I think that's true.
A lesson.
Yep. Okay. Randy, you had a comment.
When I read the power over, I translated it as being free from conditioning. And the image came up, somebody had been talking about an interview with the Dalai Lama and noted that when they talked about like the death of a mutual friend, he got very sad. And then in the next sentence, they talked about the success of another friend, and he got very happy. And there was a very immediate response. It was deep, and it was heartfelt, but it was moment by moment.
That's right.
Totally appropriate to whatever was happening at that moment.
Exactly, yes.
So is that the power over?
That's what I think this is talking about, is that it's not these magical powers, but right in each moment, you're completely there. So the power over aspiration prayers, you can give rise to those aspirations. Power over provision of necessities, whatever situation you're in, you find a way to use what is actually there.
Yeah. You're okay with it.
Yeah.
The other question is, are these ten powers, are they related to the 10 levels of bodhisattvas?
I don't think these ones actually are. They're the 10 perfections, which are related to the 10 levels of bodhisattvas. But I don't recall any correlation, but there may well be. Somebody may have done it somewhere. Okay. I want to move on and cover the section C here, if we can. There are three types of ordinary spiritual masters: those who possess 8 qualities, those who possess 4, and those who possess 2. Concerning the first one, the Bodhisattva Bhumis say, one should understand that a Bodhisattva has 8 qualities, is a perfect spiritual master. What are the 8? Possesses the moral ethics of a Bodhisattva, is learned in the Bodhisattva's teachings, possesses realization, possesses compassion and kindness, possesses fearlessness, possesses patience, possesses an indefatigable mind, and is expert in verbal expression. How many do you know?
Just you.
Yeah, right. Let's see, I can cross off 8 of those right away. I said earlier, from a certain point of view, it doesn't make any sense to talk about the teacher as an entity in his or her own right. It's an experience. And there will be times when you're sitting with someone and this may be how you experience them. Or maybe experience them as 4 or 2, said. And when you have that experience, when that experience arises, then you're capable of learning. This goes back to Jean's comment, because when you're experiencing that, you're going to be quite responsive. And it isn't necessarily the case that the teacher has all of those quantities, qualities, because again, when we speak that way, we're making the teacher into an entity. But the teacher-student relationship is a relationship, and it arises when two people interact a certain way. What's being described here are the qualities that need to be present on the teacher side of that interaction. I think it would be very useful, and I think Gunther talks about it in there, to look at the qualities that need to be present on the student side of that interaction. And that's what we're going to focus on next week, looking more at the actual interaction between how do these two people interact in a way that makes learning or awakening possible. And just to give you something to think about, we'll close with a story on this subject. Of course, they always move these stories around when I want to find them. Oh dear. Now here we are. It is related by Ibrahim Kawas that when he was a youth, he wanted to attach himself to a certain teaching master. He sought out the sage and asked to become his disciple. The teacher said, "You are not yet ready." Since the young man was insistent, the sage said, "Very well, I will teach you something. I'm going on a pilgrimage to Mecca. Come with me." The disciple was overjoyed. "Since we are traveling companions," said the teacher, "one must lead and the other obey. Choose your role." "I shall follow, you lead," said the disciple. "I shall lead if you know how to follow," said the master. The journey started. While they were resting one night in the desert of the Hejaz, it started to rain. The master got up and held a covering over the disciple, protecting him. "But this is what I should be doing for you," said the disciple. "I command you to allow me to protect you thus," said the sage. When it was day, the young man said, "Now it is a new day. Let me be the leader and you follow me." The master agreed. "I shall now collect brushwood to make a fire," said the youth. "You may do no such thing. I shall collect it," said the sage. "I command you to sit there while I collect the brushwood," said the young man. "You may do no such thing," said the teacher, "for it is not in accordance with the requirements of discipleship for the follower to allow himself to be served by the teacher." And so on every occasion, the master showed the student what discipleship really meant by demonstration. They parted at the gate of the holy city. Seeing the sage later, the young man could not meet his eyes. "That which you have learned," said the older man, "is something of the nature of discipleship." And the disciple in this one went on to become a very great teacher himself, but this is how he started. Okay. We do the dedication, please, Art.